Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome once again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and her sacraments. Well, we have a special guest for today's program, so I'm going to be as brief as possible to leave her as much time as possible. She is quite an expert, as will become apparent, on an extremely notable Jewish / Catholic figure of the beginning and middle of the 20th century, Simone Weil. That last name, should anyone be interested in looking her up later, is W-E-I-L, but she lived in France, so it's given the French pronunciation of A, but it's Simone, W-E-I-L. And she was huge in the intellectual life of the middle of the 20th century as a social activist, as a philosopher, and as a very unique sort of probably saint, having been born in a Jewish family, but having come to total faith in Christ and in the Catholic Church through a series of mystical experiences. So with that, let me just turn it over to Marie Meany, who will be our guest. Are you there, Marie?
I'm there, yes.
Great. Well, you're the expert on Simone Weil. Why don't you just start telling me and telling our audience who Simone Weil is and why she's of interest?
Excellent. Okay. I think Simone Weil intrigues, attracts, but also divides. She was not an ivory tower philosopher, but was somebody who put into practice what she thought was true and good. And I think her sense of the supernatural brings people to God or it pushes them away. So my sense is always that Simone Weil has an impact on people who read her. And interestingly, especially in the context of the 20th century and the rationalist tradition she was brought up in, she put the supernatural at the center of her philosophy, since she believed that excluding it would falsify reality. So right there, you've got somebody who's really sticking out like a sore thumb in the middle of the 20th
century.
Well,
let me stop you there. Why did she take the supernatural seriously at all?
It was because of her mystical experiences. And perhaps I'll tell you a little bit first about her life leading up to that first mystical experience, because it was somewhat prepared, even though she didn't see it coming.
Great.
So, let me just say, so she was born in 1909 in Paris to a Jewish agnostic family. So contrary to what you said, Roy, she was not raised Jewish. She only kind of found out that she was Jewish at the age of 10. But her parents were not practicing, and she really knew nothing of the lived Jewish faith. There was a grandmother who was, for whom the faith was important, but it doesn't seem that she was able to convey much to the children. Simone Weil was the second child. Her older brother was a mathematical genius who would become famous, André Weil, and she had a sort of inferiority complex vis-a-vis him, not so much because she wanted to be brilliant, but because she thought that only the genius has access to the truth, and she was always striving for the truth. And so it threw into despair in her adolescence, thinking that she was denied that access. But then, as she said, she came to the conclusion that basically everybody who seeks will find, even though she didn't know the gospel yet at the time, and overcame her despair. But though she was looking for the truth, in a way, it was part of her search for the truth that she became outspoken agnostic in her teens. As I said, her family was agnostic, and she simply decided that there was no way of knowing whether God existed or not, so that was not a problem worthwhile looking into. What she didn't realize, as she would later find out, was that God can come to you, God can descend. And that would be a big surprise for her. But she already had early on, as I said, this great love and thirst for the truth. And she would say later that she had already obeyed God's commands before knowing him. So she felt a lot of compassion for the suffering, wanted to share their lot, wanted to help them. At the age of 16, she perceived and embraced the virtue of purity and sensed a calling early on that she was not called to marriage, at least not until she had figured certain things out, and that calling was then confirmed. she came from a pretty affluent bourgeois background. Her father was a doctor, and yet she always left sister poverty and gave most of her salary away that she earned as a philosophy professor. And as I said, she would immediately put into action what she perceived to be true. There was no dichotomy between her thought and her life, between her intellectual pursuits and her activities. And this, when she was attracted to communism, as many intellectuals of her day were in the 30s, it was so because it claimed to care for the oppressed. But when she saw through it, realized that it was self-contradictory, did not actually help the poor, and furthermore poisoned them with the opium of ideology, instead of giving them what she considered the true food of religion, she criticized it very severely. But unlike many of her fellow intellectuals, she who were simply toying with communism, she wanted to understand more deeply the condition of the proletariat in order to be able to improve it. So she decided to have an industrial experience, let herself be hired. She took leave for a year from her teaching job. And that was really quite a challenge because, A, she simply used the salary she received to feed herself, and sometimes she went hungry. She was extremely clumsy manually, so it must have been very difficult for her to hold a job, and she lost it a few times and had to find different positions and various industrial plants. And it really broke her health. She had fragile health before. And after that, she really was broken in a way, in body and spirit. But she would later see that as the gift of affliction which God had given to her, and which he gives to those he wants to draw particularly close to himself. So after this year, this grueling year, her parents took her along on a holiday to Portugal to recover. And In a little poor Portuguese fishing village called Povoado do Valzim, what must have been September the 15th, so the feast day of Our Lady of Sorrows in 1935, she saw a procession, a religious procession. And the heart-wrenching hymns these villagers sang gave her the sudden insight that Christianity was the religion of slaves, of the poor, and of the oppressed, and that therefore, in a way, she belonged to it. Not that Christianity enslaved you, not at all. She didn't have a Nietzschean bent, but that it understood the condition of the poor and afflicted, and it called it by its name and took it seriously. And she said that after her industrial experience, she had received forever the red brand with which the Romans burnt on the foreheads of their most contemptible slaves. And that's why she said that she also belonged to this religion. So this had an impact on her, but nothing more flowed from that. She returned to teaching more or less, with many interruptions because of her poor health. And then during one of those leaves of absence, she went to Assisi in the spring of 1937. And there she had a very interesting experience. For in the little chapel of St. Francis, the Santa Maria degli Angeli, she said, "Something stronger than myself forced me for the first time in my life to go down on my knees." So it was not yet an explicit prayer. It was not a conscious prayer, but you could say it was the beginning of a prayer. It was a prayer through her body. It was a new step on this religious quest, which she at that point would not have identified as religious quest.
But it sounds like it was a mystical experience.
Well, she didn't...
Supernatural experience. Something forced her to her knees?
Yeah, something made her felt her... I mean, it's not like she couldn't have, but she felt that it was the right thing. So she uses strong language as something forced her to her knees, but she doesn't say that some supernatural force sort of pushed her down. That's not what she means, I think. So something was there. I think she perceived there was something. But she doesn't comment. At the time, she didn't comment on it, and she doesn't tell us any more later. Because we don't have that much to go on. She was very discreet about all of this. And as she was leaving France... in 1942, because of the German occupation, she was leaving with her parents, she had the impression she was not going to survive the war. And then she wrote some letters, particularly one to a Dominican priest, the Père Joseph Marie Perrin. And in there, she gives a sort of intellectual, religious, spiritual autobiography. And that's how we know about these things. So it's quite condensed. It's quite brief. And that's, unfortunately, all that she tells us about Assisi. So,
okay. I don't want to argue, but I would say that any time one has a semi-tangible experience of the existence of God or the presence of God, or that's what I mean, I include that in the category of mystical experience. Even if it's somewhat soft and subtle, it's still it's a window opening into the other world.
Yeah. And I guess in a certain way she would agree with that, because she speaks about mysticism as a question of degrees. But it didn't yet have that overwhelming character of making her feel like she couldn't doubt. After her strong mystical experience, which we will get to shortly, there was not the shadow of a doubt left. Okay. But let's just continue on. So this was the spring of 1937. Easter week, Holy Week, 1938, she decides to go to the Benedictine Abbey of Sulem. Like many other intellectuals of her time, she really appreciated the beauty of the liturgy and of the Gregorian chant. And she writes about that, "It goes without saying that during the divine office, the thought of the passion of Christ entered into me once and for all." So very, very powerful. But again, she doesn't say much more, except that she met a young Englishman there whose piety when he received the Eucharist really struck her, and who introduced her to the metaphysical poets, and particularly to George Herbert's poem, Love, the third one. And she learned it by heart, and she would recite it during her terrible bouts of migraine. And perhaps you know it, it starts with, "Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me go slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lack anything." And this dialogue continues, and it ends on a Eucharistic note, where love says, "You must sit down, says love, and taste my meat." So I did sit and eat. And she said she thought she only recited it as a poem. Now we're now in November 1938, so the same year she went to Sulem, 6 months later. And without her realizing it, it had become a prayer. And then she just writes very succinctly, "Christ himself came down and took me."
Could I ask you, to read it more seriously? I doubt that many of our listeners are familiar with it, and it's very beautiful in its own right, and obviously had a very soul-stirring effect on Simone Weil, even if she wasn't aware of it. So maybe it'd be worth spending a minute actually reading it.
Okay. "Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. But quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. Love said, 'You shall be he.' I, the unkind, ungrateful, 'Ah, my dear, I cannot look on thee.' Love took my hand and smiling did reply, 'Who made the eyes but I?' 'Truth, Lord, but I have marred them. Let my shame go to where it doth deserve. And know you not,' says love, 'who bore the blame? My dear, then I will serve.' 'You must sit down,' says love, 'and taste my meat.' So I did sit and eat."
Thank you.
So really, beautiful. Very beautiful. And it's interesting. So this very strong experience, and she simply says that she was glad she had not read the great mystics previous to her experience. Otherwise, she would have been afraid of having fallen prey to autosuggestion. And later on, she would say, you know, you can't have any doubt about what you've experienced, whom you've met. I mean, you would doubt more the presence of another person in your room, of your spouse, rather than the presence of God in such a circumstance. And yet, she had a scrupulous streak, and she was fearful. And it's very strange, because this was a mystic who did not start to pray for a long time, because she was afraid of autosuggestion. And interestingly, she wrote a text which is probably situated in that time, and it's called the Prologue. It's a prose poem, you could call it an allegory, and was supposed to head her oeuvre. She left it to a friend in France, Gustave Thibon, and that's what she noted, that it was supposed to come before anything that she'd written. And she takes herself back. She speaks with the discretion of the bride, who does not reveal the secrets of the nuptial chamber. But I think it's quite clear that she's speaking about herself. And she describes how Christ comes in. She is in this upper room, and he asks her to come along. And Christ takes her to a church. And there, Christ asks her, or rather the soul, and in French it's actually the soul the person is written in French, as a masculine. So she really takes herself back. So Christ asks the soul to kneel down, and though she's not baptized. And the two interlocutors go to an attic room. So that in itself, an attic room that overlooks the city. So the whole city can be seen. They are alone, and he speaks, and sometimes somebody comes in and joins the conversation. Sometimes he shares some bread with her, which he takes out of the cupboard. And she writes, "This bread really had the taste of bread. I never found that taste since." And they also drink wine, which had the taste of the sun and of the soil where the city had been built. Sometimes they lie down on the floor to sleep. And one day, he tells the subject to leave. Though he begs him on his knees, but yet he throws out the soul into the staircase, and the subject leaves the house, wanders through the streets, and cannot remember where the house was. Nor does he even try to find it again, since he believes he was called by mistake in the first place. And the text ends in this following heart-wrenching way. "I know well that he does not love me. How could he love me? And yet, at the bottom of my being, something, some part of me, cannot help to think, trembling of fear that perhaps, in spite of everything, he loves me." So this powerful text shocks by its brutal ending. One could either interpret it as Bay going through a dark night of the soul, like many mystics, or simply that she was not praying and therefore could have a sense of God's presence, since she was in a way refusing that to God. But then things changed. So Germans occupy Paris. Simone Weil leaves on the last train with her parents. They make it down to eventually Marseille. And there she meets some important people, namely, on the one hand, this Father Perrin, who would later on then raise the question of baptism with her, and this Catholic author and farmer, Gustave Thibon, who was the first to bring out a collection of her quotes called Gravity and Grace. And with Thibault, in the fall of 1941, they promise each other that they will learn the Our Father in Greek. And 2 weeks later, she suddenly remembers this promise and decides to put it into practice. And she says that from that moment on, when she would recite it with great attention, which was at least once a day, she would have a mystical experience each time. So a daily mystical experience. This is how she describes what happens. "At times, the very first words tear my thoughts from my body and transport it to a place outside space where there is neither perspective nor point of view. The infinity of the ordinary expanses of perception is replaced by an infinity to the second or sometimes the third degree. Sometimes also during this recitation or at other moments, Christ is present with me in person." So from that moment on, we see her. So daily mystical experiences. She goes to daily mass. She goes to adoration for hours. In many ways, you could say she has a very strong Eucharistic longing. And we'll get in a second to the question of why didn't she get baptized and why didn't she do it. I'll just sort of quickly end the story of her life. So as I already mentioned, her parents then wanted to leave France. They were afraid for their safety. Simone Weil really didn't. She wanted to share the lot of the French there and wanted to help and suffer. She was part of the Résistance. She even helped distribute a sort of a Catholic resistance paper. And but they wouldn't have left without her. So she decided to leave with them. They went to New York. And the moment they arrived in New York, Simone Weil desperately tried to get to England, where she wanted to work for the Free French government under de Gaulle. She eventually managed, through some connections, made it there at the end of 1942, worked for them, and this was a very, very intense and creative time. It almost feels like she sensed she wasn't going to live long. She tried to write as much as possible. And the strain of it all, and the tuberculosis that she seems to have contracted already before, took its toll, and she collapsed in the spring. And they brought her to a hospital in London and eventually to a sanatorium in Ashford, Kent. And there she died on August 24th, 1943. And it was a combination of starvation. She did not want to eat more than what she thought the French were getting under the occupation. And at that point, she couldn't eat anymore, even physically. She would have liked to, but she didn't manage. And this, and exhaustion and tuberculosis.
And she was what age, did you say?
She was 34.
Boy, a lot of saints seem to die at 33 or 34.
Yeah. It's a dangerous age. We're past that, Roy. Yes.
Wow. So, can you say something? She had this incredibly intimate relationship with Jesus. She had a Eucharistic longing. Tell me something about her relationship, A, to the Catholic Church, and B, to not being baptized.
Okay. So let me show the sort of the contradictory personality that Simone Weil is. So on the one hand, she has this strong sense of a mission. She writes to Father Perrin, "I think, as you do, that the duty for the next 2 or 3 years," so she's writing that in 1941, 1942, "so that the duty for the next 2 or 3 years, a duty so strong that one can hardly fail to fulfill it without committing treason, is to show to the public a Christianity which is really incarnate." So this is the Second World War, incredible clash of ideologies. You know, many people are dying unprepared. She's terrified of the thought of this, and she feels she has a mission. So she has a very strong sense of duty, and yet she's not baptized. And Père Perrin says that she liked to repeat that herself. She was like a bell calling people into the church without entering herself. Now, we could say this is sort of a little bit of a lame excuse, but I'll flesh it out more, and perhaps it'll become clear what was motivating her. Certainly, after her mystical experience, God became the center of her writings, explicitly and implicitly. And she certainly, as a Platonist, was the kind of person who wouldn't be satisfied with simply contemplating the good outside of the cave, but was going to come back into the cave to tell others about it. And you know, what else could you expect from someone who fell in love with God like she did, and who wrote that God alone is worthy of our concern and absolutely nothing else? She also said, you know, again, to show you this her sense of this time of crisis and of death, "Never in all the history we actually know has there been a time when souls have been as much in peril as throughout the whole globe." Okay, and yet she was not baptized, except perhaps on her deathbed by a friend, and I'll get to that in a second. So what were her problems with the Catholic Church? And there were quite a few. So on the one hand, it was an issue that she was grappling with. And to the very end, she would still talk to visitors coming to her about the Catholic Church and wondering and suffering from the fact that she couldn't make that step. So it was certainly something she thought was very important. But she had certain issues. So the one was that she had problems with what she saw to be social organizations. You know, she liked to quote the thing where God said, "Well, you know, if 2 or 3 come together to pray in my name, there I will be." But she says, "Well, not," he didn't say millions. And she thought the moment that when there was a mass of people coming together, a sort of collectivity, she thought that people would lose their freedom and there would be a kind of, sort of, you know, put strongly, a sort of mob, that would develop. And she was a very perceptive observer. And of course she saw, Catholics who were there for, you know, the fuzzy fellow feelings that they got being around other Catholics and not necessarily for the right reasons. So simply it was also the sign of her times when collectivities were so strong, when people were just following the masses, and she saw that as a problem, and she was afraid of that. She also was afraid that she would lose her intellectual freedom, and because not only in having to accept dogma so far, which she would have been willing to, but not knowing what was still going to come. And also, and again, I think she had a really scrupulous streak. Long letter to a priest. It's called Letter to a Priest. That it was never meant to be published. He was called Père Couturier. He was in America at the time. And she made a long list of 35 points and questions asking if she could become a Catholic while holding onto them as possibility, merely as possibilities. So many of these were mere speculations, but she simply didn't want to have to discard them since in case they turned out to be true. So some of them were like multiple incarnations of Christ, and couldn't some of the previous religions have already been pre-Christian? So that was one thing, and the priest never answered her, and I don't blame him because he certainly was a lot better and it would have been very difficult to answer. And now it becomes a problematic part of Simone Weil. It is precisely because of the Catholic Church's Jewish heritage and its links with the Old Testament that she had problems with it. Now, one has to understand again. So Simone Weil was 10 years old when she heard that the family was Jewish, but it didn't mean anything to her. She didn't know the Jewish religion from the inside. She was never introduced to it. She had read the Old Testament from cover to cover a few times, but without looking at Jewish or Catholic commentaries. So she didn't know what the answers were or the interpretive, the hermeneutic tools to understand some of the difficult passages. And she was shocked by certain passages, as I guess we all are. And her main point of criticism was that the Jewish religion, as it is depicted in parts of the Old Testament, commits the sin of idolatry, not in adoring pagan gods, which it often does, and then gets chided by God and the Jewish people return back, but by turning its nation into an idol. So by a sort of temporal messianism. And she thinks, and she's very harsh here, she thinks it was intrinsic to the religion. And it's a basic human temptation, thus to choose power or force, as she liked to call it, rather than love. And it doesn't mean that she thought everything in the Old Testament was false. No, there are parts of the Old Testament that she loved, like the beginning of Genesis, Job, most of the Psalms, the wisdom books, the Song of Songs, Isaiah, part of Ezekiel, Daniel, Tobit. But she thought these parts were sort of brought in by other traditions, by other cultures, and weren't really Semitic. So what was good and true in the Old Testament, she thought stemmed from other cultures, the wisdom of Egypt or of Greece.
So she was one of the original self-hating Jews.
Well, so she would have liked much more for the Christianity to be Hellenicized. She thought the big problem of the Catholic Church was that it was too influenced by its Jewish roots and too influenced by its Roman roots. And had it only stuck to the Greek influence, then it would have been in much better shape.
Well, let me pause for a moment there. We usually take a short break for station identification halfway through. And we'll resume this conversation with Marie Meany about Simone Weil in a moment or two. Welcome back. You're listening to Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria with your host Roy Shoman. That's me. And with our special guest for today, Marie Meany, who is quite a specialist on and is here to talk about Simone Weil. With that, Marie, why don't you just continue from where I so rudely interrupted you?
Okay. So I suggest we look a little bit at at the arguments of Simone Weil, or just her thoughts. It's not necessarily thought out arguments. One has to remember that Simone Weil was sort of doing this as a conversation with herself and other people. This was not meant for publication. She was not trying to give people reasons for not becoming Catholic at all. It was more that she was trying to work through things and that she was throwing at people things that she was grappling with and she had problems with. And sometimes hyperbolically overstating them just to see what the response would be. So I think it has to be read in that light. So Let me just sort of hone in on a few things. So with regard to Christianity, as I mentioned, she had this idea that somehow in other cultures, perhaps especially, for example, in the Greek ancient culture, Christianity in a way was lived much more, perhaps even than it was later within the Catholic Church, and certainly than in Judaism. And she had this great liking of myths, and in a way, seems to completely overlook the absolutely revolutionary aspect of Christianity. And I think sort of she has a point with some of the myths, and the way she interprets them is absolutely astounding, and she gives a sort of Christological reading of them that can be quite convincing, or at least is very compelling. But she doesn't seem to see how, within the Jewish faith, God enters history and breaks through the cycle of mythological religion and makes a covenant with his people and reveals himself, and how he breaks people free from the gods of the mythological religion, bringing reason into the picture. So I think she's not quite sufficiently clear here in how far enlightenment is really part of Christianity, whereas at most mythological religions could develop to the point that they would see myth as a symbol of a reality, perhaps to experience some mysticism, or at worst, could completely dismantle myth and leave men atheistic. And this is something, by the way, that Ratzinger points out. So it is interesting to see that the early apologists, the early church fathers, sought points of contact with ancient philosophy, not with the ancient religion. And Simone Weil, I think, is a little bit blue-eyed and naive here. She's convinced that many ancient myths expressed pre-Christian revelations and gave them an idealized reading. So to see in somebody like Dionysius a Christological figure is, I think, a huge stretch. Well, yes, he is killed and resurrects, but, you know, that's about as far as it reaches to my mind. And if we only think of something like Euripides' Bacchae, where he leads people in their madness to tear people apart and gets them into sort of orgiastic fits, I don't understand quite where she gets that from. But anyway, she absolutely ignores or rejects the idea that people were subjected to these gods who enslaved them, and does not seem to see them as they were rightly, I think, seen by early church fathers as being demons. She was aware of the existence of demons, by the way, but she doesn't seem to ascribe any greater presence to them in the pagan religions than elsewhere. So she doesn't either seem to acknowledge, it seems to me, that people were afraid of gods and tried to appease them and didn't have a relationship of love with them most of the time, but sort of tried to pragmatically sort of use this do ut des, I give and you give me, you know, at best, and hope to keep them at bay from their anger.
But what about the fact that Jesus was Jewish? Did she acknowledge that Christianity, that Judaism was a precondition for Christianity?
No, she does not address that.
Okay.
I mean, she would, of course, have acknowledged that Christ was a Jew, but she would have said that he was not following the kind of temporal messianism that was present in the Old Testament. And that's also why he was rejected, because he didn't engage in that. He was not following this, the language of this is about a nation becoming the greatest nation on earth.
But it's bigger than that, right? Because Judaism was required to bring about Christ.
I know.
But she doesn't seem to be picking up on that.
No, okay. She doesn't. Okay. She doesn't. That's a real blind spot. Anyway, so then she has an interesting view on dogma. She sees dogma, she thinks dogma should be a sort of a way of orienting our gaze, a sort of way of seeing things. And she had problems with it only in the sense that she was afraid that it would sort of force one's intelligence to adhere to something. And she says intelligence cannot be forced. But we could, of course, say, well, it's not intelligence on its own, but the whole person and her heart and will to adhere. And I think she was sort of acknowledged that herself in the way that she dealt with dogma, in wanting to understand and accept the mysteries. And I think you have a beautiful quote there, Roy, but it's about adopting, embracing those mysteries, not so much as an object of intelligence, though intelligence also has to find clarity, but of supernatural love. So the way she interprets faith is as the subordination of all faculties of the soul to the faculty of supernatural love. So it is essentially an act of trust. And in a way, I therefore don't quite understand why she can't understand that one can do that vis-a-vis the church. So if one has recognized the church as truly the representative of Christ on church, so that clearly does not mean putting one's intelligence under totalitarian rule, but with one's faith subordinating all of one's faculties of the soul to this faculty of the supernatural love with which one embraces the church as the embodiment of Christ. But, you know, for whatever reason, Vid just couldn't make this step. She couldn't make this act of trust, and in order to remain intellectually honest, she didn't. So, of course, she would have agreed, you know, that faith and reason do not and cannot contradict each other. So, but in practice, in theory, she would agree with that, but in practice, somehow, she is worried that along the line, something might happen where she might be asked to go against reason. And therefore, she held back. At the same time, then she thinks, you know, that everything that is good and true is also Christian. So she has that vision. She, to quote her, there is no Christian point of view as well as other points of view alongside, but only truth and error. Everything that is true is Christian. So you wonder why that kind of insight didn't manage to leaven through her whole sensibility and her reason, but for whatever reason, she just didn't get there. And the Berberin said, you know, she died young. She was still sort of on the journey, and she hadn't completed it yet. And, you know, we can only speculate what would have happened. But I think she was certainly struggling for it. She saw its importance. And my father, who wrote the first major biography on Simone Weil, so he's called Jacques Gabou, he thinks, and I agree with him, that Simone Weil had the baptism of desire. She had a great desire for Christ. She had a tremendous thirst for the Eucharist. I mean, it must have cost her so much not to be able to receive Christ in the Eucharist. She said, Christ wants one, in a way, if we can put it that way, she has this paradoxical way of putting things, he wants one to prefer truth to him. So, of course, she would say that Christ is the truth, so there's no contradiction, but in a way, she cannot go against, at the moment, what she perceives to be real obstacles.
But it's actually the ascent of faith to dogma which was the stumbling block.
Well, I think it was one of them. It was one of them. I mean, I think, as I said, the Jewish side was problematic to her. And also her understanding of, you know, since Christ had come to her in a mystical experience, she had a strange, I think, from her own experience, she had this idea that she only does where she feels this impulse of God to do it. Now, of course, she followed the moral law, and she didn't have a particular impulse for that. But for this kind of a thing, something as serious as a conversion, she had the impression God would sort of make it clear to her, would ask her to do it. And she didn't seem to understand that God would just speak through the centuries, through his church. And since she didn't feel that particular, this private, this personal call, she didn't feel compelled to do it. I mean, I guess in terms of Judaism, you're more the one to answer her there. But briefly, Ratzinger says, you know, Judaism was not set in stone from the beginning. So the word of God reveals itself gradually in a process of encounters in the course of man's search for answers to his ultimate questions. So it did not simply fall directly from heaven, but is a real synthesis of cultures. So, you know, by pointing out that there was an influence of Greece and of Egypt, this is not proving that, therefore, the Jewish religion was false and only that which came from the outside was right, but simply that this was the process of the revelation sort of happening through time. And let me see. I think I will let you rather do the Jewish part if you want to, but let me just quickly hone in on still on the question of baptism, since that's a tricky one. So Simone Weil supposedly said, as one friend says, that if one day she was in a coma, she wanted to be baptized. So in a way, if she wasn't anymore having to deal with these different intellectual issues, this would be the final act she would want to pose, in a way, before dying. Now, Simone Weil had a friend, Simone Dates, who had come over from America with her. She was also friends. She was also a Jewish convert. But she was baptized. And she claims that she baptized Weil at the London hospital, which was called the Middlesex Hospital. Now, the problem with Simone Dates is that she is not a reliable witness. She gave different versions of this. She told stories of Simone Weil that had supposedly happened and that then turned out had not happened. So, unfortunately, we can't completely trust her. And then She was also unclear as to where, at this one point she says, well, the Middlesex Hospital, then she didn't know anymore. Now, if Simone Weil really baptized, Simone Weil at the Middlesex Hospital, why did Simone Weil, when she was brought to the Ashford Sanatorium, when she was asked what her religion was, why did she keep quiet? The nurses said that she refused to state what her religion was, either because it hadn't happened or because it didn't mean that much to her. And to a doctor who was there, she said she was Jewish, desired to be Catholic, but still had problems concerning one point. So it seems that when she arrives at the Ashford Hospital, she's not baptized. But perhaps, you know, even though Simone Dates is a little bit unreliable, perhaps she did it. Perhaps after fall, she did it in the Ashford Hospital. We will not know. But let me tell you two stories. The one is of Padre Pio. And a friend went to see Padre Pio, worried about Simone Weil's fate, since she had probably died unbaptized. And Padre Pio said, ah, è una santa. She's a saint. And I have to say that you get the sense of heroic virtue in her, of tremendous caritas, of tremendous charity towards others. I mean, she lived such an ascetic life. She was so turned towards God and towards the pursuit of truth. She wanted to give her life for as a victim soul. When she went to England to work for the Free French, her real hope was that she would be sent on towards France again and passed on a sort of no-return mission, parachuted into perhaps even a concentration camp trying to free people or on some sort of clandestine mission to the Resistance. Now, the people from the Free French government didn't want to send her at all because they didn't just want to send somebody to their death, and they pretty much knew that Simone Weil, the way she was going to be spotted very quickly and wasn't going to last very long. But that was her desire. Also, she had this other plan. She was hoping to put together a group of frontline nurses who would be willing to risk their lives in not just giving medical support to the soldiers who were wounded and who couldn't be reached at that point during combat time by the Red Cross, but also give them spiritual support. And in a way, that would be a real spiritual answer to the spiritual problem that was Nazism. Because she said, you know, if the power of arms is not enough. Now, she thought that was important, the power of arms to try to combat Hitler. But at the same time, it was not sufficient, since this Nazism was a form of an ideology that was ultimately an idolatry, and it was a false religion. And only the absolute form of love, of complete self-giving love, to the point of being willing to give one's life, would be the right kind of response. So it's quite striking. So this is the one story. The other story I want to tell you is an Anglican minister who told my father the following dream that led to his conversion. And he had been a movie maker, and one day he had this dream. And there were many parts of this dream, and one of them was that he was in Paris, and he went into this apartment, was ushered into a room, and saw this woman who looked extremely intelligent, and he didn't know what to say. So because she was so intelligent, he said, well, you must know many languages, which was actually a fact. Simone Weil knew many languages. And she said, ah, where I am, we only speak one language, which she understood to mean the language of love. And he woke up from that dream. And later on, he went to visit the parents of Simone Weil, and he went to that apartment, and he recognized it from the dream. And he recognized her also in the pictures. So these are kind of nice anecdotes about Simone Weil.
Wow.
An interesting thought, and that would also explain Simone Weil's own approach, is she had this idea of an implicit love of God, an implicit love and faith of God that exists, which she had experienced herself, as she says, you know, how come that I obeyed your commands before I knew you? And she thinks this love of God can express itself in love for one's neighbor. One can encounter him through also the liturgy, which she did when she was, you know, as yet had not received any mystical experience, but somehow felt this was the tearing apart of the veil. The beauty of the world and friendship, also simply in seeing mathematical, understanding mathematical truths, and in sanctity. And later on, she came to see also in the Eucharist. So she thought that faith and caritas were both essential to salvation and couldn't be separated. And she thinks Christ himself shows that to us when he refers to the Last Judgment and calls those blessed who helped him without realizing it was him. So it is not enough to say, Lord, Lord, but in a way it's not too little to help Christ and the poor. It's a sort of lived faith. And she believed that atheists could love him and believe in him implicitly when genuinely loving other people unconditionally. So Simone Weil is heterodox, and I think this poses problems to Catholics, and rightly so. But the Père Perrin said, you know, she's not a solution, but a question. She's not an answer, but a call. Not a conclusion, but a challenge. And I think whatever Simone Weil's difficulties with the church were, or whatever the nature of her heterodox ideas are, her significance lies in the sense she had of the supernatural and her capacity of conveying it to her readers. It's really, I mean, it is the central focus after mystical experience, becomes the central focus of her writing. And she analyzes it from a philosophical perspective, which is incredibly daring. And yet I find tremendously convincing.
What writing are you referring to, if anyone wants to turn in that direction?
Oh, I mean, it's everywhere afterwards. But there's, for example, her prologue to her work, The Need for Roots, where she tries to speak in terms, in a sort of language that would be acceptable to non-believers about the supernatural. And she starts this foundational text where she's thinking already of France after the war. How can we rebuild France? What kind of government do we want? How can we re-Christianize society? And she starts this text by saying, well, let me just quote this to you. There is a reality outside the world. That is to say, outside space and time, outside man's mental universe, outside any sphere whatsoever that is accessible to human faculties. Corresponding to this reality, the center of the human heart, is the longing for an absolute good, a longing which is always there and is never appeased by any object of this world. So she is tremendously Augustinian and Pascalian there. So there is this infinite longing in the human heart. And if human beings are honest with themselves, they will realize that there's nothing in this world, nothing finite, no spouse, no success, no passion, no art, no intellectual pursuit that can satisfy that incredible infinite hunger. Only God can. And she tries to tune into that. So she, on the one hand, gives a sort of anthropological existential proof. Another interesting, she has many approaches in an article on Marxism. I'm trying to remember which one. I'm tempted to think it's, is there a Marxist doctrine? Where in order to grapple with Marxism, in order to criticize, she has to show the existence of the supernatural, since this is something that communism excludes. But in order to make publicity for myself, I've written an article on this proof of Simone Weil and the supernatural. And if you go onto my academia.edu page, you can find it there.
Okay, wait. Remember, please, we have a couple of minutes. Make an advertisement for yourself. Certainly let them know where they can hear you more on the internet or, you know, where they can drink at the fountain of your wisdom after the show is over.
Okay, so like many academics, I have a page on academia.edu with various published or unpublished articles.
You might want to even spell your name.
Okay, so my name is Marie Meany, M-E-A-N, like no, E-Y. And I've written several books on Simone Weil. The one is in English. That's on Simone Weil's apologetic use of literature. So it's about her Christological readings of ancient Greek texts like the Antigone, the Iliad, Electra, Prometheus Bound. And then for those of you who read German, I recently brought out a book called, translated into English. It's called Bridges to the Supernatural, Brücken zum Übernatürlichen. And in that, I deal with Simone Weil's understanding of the supernatural, her analysis of totalitarian evil in dialogue with Hannah Arendt. also her understanding of religion. And there I make her, let her dialogue with Ratzinger, because I think Ratzinger gives a lot of the answers that, that, Simone Weil would have needed to hear. But you can find most of those, some of those in English on my, my academia.edu page. So, anyway, to get back to my train of thought, Simone Weil challenges her reader. She confronts them with the reality of the supernatural and thus provokes strong reactions. And some people simply hate her. Like, they hated her during her life. She was very original. She stuck out like a sore thumb. She loved to discuss. And she could be a difficult, unpleasant, uncomfortable bedfellow. But I think her aim is well expressed. Let me just give you a quote out of her essay, God in Plato. What man can do for man is not to bring something to him, but to turn him towards the light which comes from elsewhere, from above. So, you know, we can't give faith to ourselves. It is a gift of God. All we can do is ourselves or help others to be willing to open up to that possibility, to open up to the existence of God. And that might mean a long wait. You know, like Christ says in the parable, you have to wait during the night for the thief, like a thief or like a servant for the master. And you have no idea when he's going to come. And sometimes God lets people wait for a tremendously long time. But that's in order to purify us more probably. And that's therefore that she speaks about waiting as an absolutely key spiritual virtue that is too little talked about. It does include hope because it means hanging on when it feels like nothing is ever going to happen and looking with great attention, at the teachings that we have, at the dogmas also that she had problems with. She didn't simply discard them. She said she would look at them until she would hope that light would break forth like it had happened to her for other things. So she said that it was a terrible act of treason to sort of push something aside simply because you didn't understand it and to dismiss it. We have to deal with mysteries that are something very, sometimes very difficult to understand together, such as the existence of the necessity and the good in this world, meaning, you know, how can evil exist if there's a good and omnipotent God, and yet evil exists and God exists, and the easy way out is to dismiss the one or the other and to propose a false solution. So it means it's a challenge. It means having to wait. But then to be there when God himself descends. And it's the great tragedy that the world does not realize. It's St. Francis said, who was weeping, that love is not loved. And so therefore, Simone Weil's message, I would say, and this is a quote, is there is only one truth which is worthy to witness to. It is that God is love.
Well, that's a pretty good place to end. I hate to do it, but the time has come. So I just want to thank you very, very, very much. And
it's a pleasure.
I hope that Simone Weil has sparked the interest of a number of our listeners, and that they turn to your page on academia.edu. And I certainly want to read more, in particular, about Simone Weil's exposition of the mystical and the supernatural. So with that, it's come time to go. So I just want to thank you again. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me, Roy.
And I want to, thanks. And I want to thank our listeners for listening. You've been listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. And I hope you come back again, same time, same place next week. Bye for now.